is continuing with John Evans on 8th August 78. So you were referring to, I asked you about later on, Lovell accepted quite a bit of American money.
Yes, essentially what happened was that the telescope, as it was nearing completion, it was clear that there was a large overrun, there was going to be some kind of public scandal. And Lovell was in a very vulnerable position because at least the Public Accounts Committee took the view that he had colluded with, was in collusion with the architects, the consulting engineers, in changing the design. Now, what actually had happened is that Husbands, the architect, right, the consulting engineers, had told Lovell that the change of the design would actually reduce costs. And he was probably right, but the combination of strikes and the fact the thing would take much longer to build than anybody had anticipated really ran up the bill. And so Lovell felt, you know, I'm sure that his neck was on the chopping block. And what really proved to be a savior was the launch of Sputnik. Although Lovell didn't quite realize it at the time, the Sputnik was launched, the telescope was essentially all but finished in that the surface was there and the motors were installed, but we didn't have servo control of it. So you could move it only by essentially throwing on the breakers and then pulling them off again.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't steer it or anything. And there's intense interest in Britain in this because it represented Britain's only contribution to the space age, which suddenly became banner headlines, you know, overnight. And reporters descended on George Banks to see what we were doing about, you know, space.
Right, what are you doing about it?
And we were doing nothing, and Lovell sort of said the telescope wasn't finished, and we couldn't. And consulting engineers, Husbands, put out a counter public, you know, release saying it was finished, and the only, you know, only reason people at George Banks weren't doing anything was that their equipment wasn't ready. This kind of put us on the spot. So we hurriedly connected both the moon radar to it via very long transmission lines, lost about 10 dB of power, and installed on it a small transportable meteor radar. And this happened more or less over the weekend. It was launched on a Friday, and the next Wednesday we got echoes with the meteor radar from the carrier rocket. And about by the Friday, a week after it had been launched, we got echoes with the moon radar and the carrier rocket.
But there hadn't been any urgency before Sputnik and the press and so forth.
Anyway, the amount of news coverage that all of this generated sort of really, I think, over the period of that week, convinced Lovell that he was a tool that could be exploited, namely the press and British patriotism. And so he kept us working on tracking Sputnik, and the carrier rocket in particular, by radars. We were the only group doing it. And kept us in the attention of the press.
Right.
And would use times when he was talking to the press at Jogwell to complain about the niggardliness of the British government, the fact he couldn't pay his phone bill, to sort of bring public opinion round on his side, so that when the full extent of the scandal became clear, he was more or less in an impregnable position.
Right.
And never did go to jail.
Sputnik really was a savior then.
Well,
but so I also suspect that probably he got to like this mode of dealing with the press, and when the space age kept on going on, he was.
Yes, my view was that he had previously tended to shun press, but he sort of developed almost the qualities of a ringmaster of a circus. Now for my next trick, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And began to enjoy it, and became essentially in Britain the spokesman for what was going on in the space age, and would every few months or so say whether the Russians or the Americans were first in the race to get to the moon.
Right. And of course, his stunt of intercepting the Russian photographs,
yes,
and so forth. Well, okay, this is straying a little bit. Let me see now. You worked on this lunar radar. Are there any other aspects of what you did at Jodrell Bank and the lunar radar that we should cover?
Very little. The big thing that we did after the telescope was finished was move the lunar radar and put it out physically on the telescope, primarily for the satellite tracking work. But it did enable us to do the same experiment now continuously tracking the moon.
You were doing the satellite tracking via radar, not the transponder. On the...
Yes. We were the first group, probably anywhere, to get radar returns from the carrier rocket. And that was really only a stunt, but the implications, political implications, were that this was a... the booster for a warhead that had put the satellite into orbit, and could you actually track such a thing?
Right. And what was its size and all this?
So we did some work. I, with a guy called Nick Taylor, did some work where we would track the moon from moonrise to moonset, essentially, on many days. And he and I wrote a paper on some results we obtained in winter.
Oh, yes, in Nature?
No, it's a paper in, I think it's JATP.
I don't have one here with Taylor on that. At least maybe it was after 1960.
It was after 1960.
Oh, that's why it's not here.
The actual work was done just before I left, and we jointly wrote the paper while I was over here. So that was the last, essentially, big piece of work we did.
But by this time, this telescope was tracking, and you were following the...
Yes.
Following the moon. What about this... before we get to Venus, let's see if there's anything else on the lunar radar. You had a paper in JATP in 57 on the Faraday effect and so forth. What were you able actually to find out about the ionosphere from that?
Well, the major thing we found out was that the extent of the ionosphere was such that from the bottom side with a swept frequency sound, you're only seeing about, say, one third of the total number of electrons, or one quarter rather. There's three times as many electrons above the peak of the layer to below. And this had implications about the actual formation of the F layer. It was, in fact, what Radcliffe chose to call at the time a Bradbury-type layer. That is, it's a layer formed essentially because of the fact that production fell off less rapidly than loss above the F1 peak. The loss in the ionosphere turns out to be something that depends on the abundance of molecular ions like N2 and O2. They fall off with a scale height which is half that of atomic oxygen.
I see.
But the production is proportional to the abundance of atomic oxygen. So above the level of peak production, which is about 180 kilometers, you have loss falling off less rapidly than, I've got to put it the wrong way around, production falling off less rapidly than loss. And so if it were just a chemical equilibrium situation, the density would actually grow. It doesn't, because it's downward diffusion. So you actually have a layer in which production loss and downward diffusion of the ionization trying to form a its own scale height distribution are the three forces. And what we should have been able to recognize, what was obvious was that a 3-to-1 ratio top to bottom was not what you'd expect for, even for such a layer, you'd expect about 2-to-1. And that meant the temperature of the particles in the top part of the layer had to be fairly high. And we didn't actually realize what the cause of that was, and later from incoherent scattering, but determined that in fact the electrons are twice as hot as the ions.
I see. Let me ask about the relationship between... I noticed that there was a paper at the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 55 and at the Paris Symposium in 58 on your work. What was the relation between the radio and radar astronomers? Was it really a pretty distinct little subfield? Or was it just another specialty?
It was probably viewed as a specialty within radio astronomy at the time. There was the Paris Symposium, I think had as its first session radar astronomy, and nobody really seemed to object to it being included in the program.
But it was the sort of thing where you were part of the community. It was not...
Yes.
A separate thing.
The ionospheric work was distinctly separate, but the radar astronomy wasn't.
And at that time, if someone had asked you, what are you, what do you do at a cocktail party, what would you answer?
Well, I would have said it was a radar astronomer.
A radar, so that term was in vogue.
It was in vogue,
Okay.
That would have allowed you more moments chatting, explaining the difference between radar and radio.
Well, that's still true, of course. All right, let's move on to beyond the moon, namely, there's a paper here with Evans, and Taylor, 59 Nature, on a 2.5 sigma result for Venus echoes.
Yes, which proved to be wrong.
But could you tell me about that experiment?
Yes, well, the other ambition Lovell had, besides getting echoes from the Moon, was to get echoes from Venus. And so after I got my PhD, or as I was about to get it, he gave me the job of building a Venus radar. And that was a major step, because you needed about another 70 dB to get from the Moon to Venus. That is, the total round-trip path loss, if you had a 1-watt signal radiated isotropically from the Moon, was something like 240 dB. And now, if you're going to do Venus, it was 310 or something dB. Right. Picking up 70 dB, even though we had the big telescope, was a major challenge. We had to go up in frequency to get more antenna gain. We went up to 408 megacycles. Mm-hmm. We also had to have a high-power transmitter. And for that, we depended on a klystron, a homemade klystron that the physics department people had.
I see.
Which they'd built from some kind of accelerator. And it was a horrible beast. It was supposed to give us about 100 kilowatts peak power with a 30 millisecond pulse. But it was, you know, all made of brass and copper and was continuously pumped. And the people in the department had managed to persuade, I think it was English Electric, to give us a modulator for it, which consisted of an enormous delay line, which you charged up to something like 5 kV. And this produced a pulse which went into an ordinary big 50-cycle mains transformer.
I see.
Stepped it from 5 kV to 60 kV, by just swapping the 60 kV pulse to this thing. We had to put this whole thing up in the top of one of the towers of the telescope. And we only put the klystron up there, and we left all of the modulator and things down on the ground. We piked the 5 kV pulse up in coax to the pulse transformer, which is also up in the tower. We had to bring liquid nitrogen for the vacuum pump up the elevator and then up vertically two flights of steps. Oh, just running it was a nightmare. And, We really had hoped to get echoes in 57 when the nearest conjunction occurred, but it was totally impossible. And nevertheless, the group over at Lincoln Lab claimed to get the detection. And so when the next chance came around, we had the high-power radar working almost. We chose to try and integrate. What you have to do is make a hypothesis about what the total size of the solar system is, the astronomical unit, because we had only a limited range window. We had to integrate in the noise to find the echoes. But in addition, you have to track that those range windows along at the rate you think the distance of Venus is changing.
Right.
And you have to tune the receiver in Doppler. Doppler shifts were of the order of 30 or 40 kilocycles, and we had a pulse that only had a width of about 30 or 40 cycles, so we had to precisely tune the receiver off, precisely set the range gates, precisely keep each of those adjusted with time.
Right, and the standard values for the AU and so forth were
poorly known.
To the extent that
there were two good values, each of which claimed an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 4th, but differed by 1 part in 10 cubed. And anyway, we chose to adopt the Lincoln Lab estimate, and
based on their 57
results,
claim.
And ran the experiment, having a lot of problems. We kept blowing up we had the problem of a rotary joint for the elevation axis. We had to get the power out, and we accomplished this with just essentially taking some flexible cable through a hole in the elevation bearing. And there was a coupler there that just wouldn't stand the power.
Nice.
We kept blowing this coupler up, and we had other problems. And that result was we never got any very long runs in. And if you took what you thought were to be the reliable portions of the runs we did have and added them all together, then you got this 2.5 sigma bump at about the right range. And I debated for long whether to believe this was an echo or not. And Lovell began to put pressure on because the Duke of Edinburgh was coming or something, and he wanted to either tell the Duke we had or we had not. Evans, will you make up your mind? And It was very unfair, actually. And looking back on it, I think it's the one big mistake I made. I sort of caved in and said, well, yeah, I think we did get echoes.
And the Duke was duly informed.
The Duke was duly informed, and so was the press, and we had to write a Nature article. It turned out we didn't, and the Lincoln work itself was spurious. They had an even larger return, about 5 sigma. So it wasn't until...
In 59 they also had a spurious return?
No. In 59 they tried again and failed to repeat their results.
Okay, so you were comparing with their 57 results.
Yes.
And so, even though you came out with a significantly smaller signal, you still under the pressure and so forth.
Yes. Although it was discouraging because our radar was much more sensitive than theirs, and if they really had it right, we should have seen a much bigger echo. And the fact that at that time I didn't know that they'd failed to repeat their results, but when it became obvious that they hadn't, and noting the disparity in their claimed cross-section and our cross-section, began to doubt that we really had achieved an echo long before we disproved it.
Now, you say that you used ephemeris values that agreed with their claim from 57. Now, how did that agree with the standard optical?
Well, it was quite dissimilar from either of the two. As proved to be the real value when it was finally obtained.
But still somewhat different from the 57 one, I guess, since that wasn't real. Okay, let's see. You reported this at an RAS meeting I have here, also an observatory, in December 59. Obviously, it seems that the radar astronomy was integrated in with the traditional astronomers as much as radio at that time.
Yes.
So, at this stage, you're perking along quite a bit at Jarrow Bank. And what was the next step?
Well, because we'd got this large telescope, Jarrow Bank was a kind of mecca for visiting Americans, of whom in those days were large numbers. And for reasons I never quite understood, Lovell frequently gave me the job of escorting them around. Maybe he thought I was more entertaining than some of the other members of his staff. And I got to know a fair number of people, including the likes of Gordon Pettengill. And got an invitation, essentially, from von Eschelmann to consider going to Stanford. And he arranged, under the subterfuge of my going over to an IRSI meeting, a fall US IRSI meeting, which was going to be held in San Diego, the chance to go to Stanford and discuss this with him in 58. And that I did. And whilst I was there, I also visited the group at Boulder, Colorado, headed by Ken Bowles, who were in the process of starting up their big radar at Hicamarca in Peru.
Oh, yes.
And indicated to Ken my interest in incurrent scatter. It seemed to be a very powerful technique and something I dearly wanted to get into. And then there was another meeting in the US in the spring of 59. On radar astronomy held at MIT, which I went to, and maybe getting these confused. At all events, it is a result of people coming through Jodrell and a result of my going over there to the States a couple of times. I ended up with sort of three job offers, or four really, one at Stanford University, one at SRI, one at Lincoln Lab, and one at Boulder, and chose the Lincoln one. Ended up going there in the summer of 60.
This meeting at MIT I haven't heard about before. Were there any published proceedings of that? Or
I don't believe
it sort of
so. It was a workshop. And it was attended by all of the people in the field at the time. Hmm. And it was held at Endicott House, which is a sort of house.
Yes, I know about that.
I've got the story wrong. That was in the fall of 58, I think.
Yeah. Still, I've never heard about that. I wish there were some proceedings. But now, it must have appeared to you that the future at Jarrow Bank in terms of radar astronomy was not going to be as bright as in the US.
There were two things that consistently bothered me. One was the unreliability of our transmitter. I mean, the corresponding transmitter at Lincoln was a 2.5 megawatt versus our 100 kilowatt transmitter. their average power was greater than our peak powers, 150 kilowatts for average power.
Mm-hmm.
It was very flexible. You could adjust the pulse length from 10 microseconds to about 4 milliseconds. And our very long pulses, plus the phase instability within the pulses, meant that we couldn't do the kinds of experiments we wanted to, even if, you know, we didn't know what the right astronomical unit was. Plus, the other thing we lacked was a digital computer. They had used a general-purpose digital computer for doing the integration, and we had a home-built integrator which only covered a very small number of range windows. They could cover as many as they wanted. And I consistently campaigned with Lovell, essentially, that we'd have to compete in kind if we were to stay in the race. And either he couldn't or he wouldn't accept this. He just felt, I guess, he was so overextended on the telescope, he didn't want to try and lay any further claims to public money for a large radar.
Yeah.
And sort of kept putting me off with arguments that, well, you know, the British have a genius for getting around problems, you know, and you think of something kind of thing.
Great amounts of money.
And unfortunately, yeah. There's no simple, you know, I mean, it the radar equation is there, and you can't adjust any of the terms by just being clever. And so, in fact, the writing was on the wall that we couldn't persist.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that proved to be the case.
Well, in fact, I think when you left, essentially the whole effort closed down, did it not?
Well, not immediately. John Thompson, who I'd worked with, carried on, and they did succeed in getting Venus echoes with the radar that I had built.
In what year was that?
In 60, or 61, I forget whenever it was. Again, probably early 61. So the radar did work. We told them what the astronomical unit was. We determined it at Lincoln. We cabled them the value. They re-ran all their ephemerides to look at that particular range, found an echo, and published it to Nature as if they'd done it themselves, which galled us enormously, gave us no recognition whatsoever. I didn't tell them.
Let me ask about the business about integration. Was it all done online and there was no post-processing?
Well, that was one thing we tried to change. Was the first effort was all done online. We actually had a voltage-to-frequency converter, which was terribly crude. It simply consisted of a large amplifier, which took the video signal and drove it into an RC network. And the capacitor in the RC network was discharged when the voltage got big enough a little neon, which lit.
I see.
And so you had a variable frequency multivibrator, if you will. The number of pulses this produced was roughly proportional to the voltage being applied, and was spread through a number of gates into counters, mm-hmm. which were these Decatron things, remember, yeah. the little dots going right. around. Finally, to post office type relay counters. And so we just had something like 8 channels of this. I mean, it had 8 sort of adjacent range windows. Very, very crude. But before I left, we had taken steps to buy a good tape recorder so that we could tape record the signals along with timing marks, and if we failed to get an echo in real time, try other hypotheses in non-real time.
Another question that occurred to me was that you said you were seriously considering going to Boulder, which would have been pretty much purely ionospheric.
Yes.
Work. So you, at that stage, you were quite willing to do either.
Yes.
You didn't think of yourself purely as a radar astronomer.
I sort of oscillated back and forth on that, and even at when I came to Lincoln, there was the prospect of doing incoherent scatter because the Milton radar had already done
some.
I see. And so I knew there was that opening, that possibility.
Well, can you tell me now about the detection at Lincoln? I guess in 61 it was.
Yes, well, we essentially repeated the experiment we'd done before, but by this time the Lincoln radar was really shaken down, was running at full power. And in its most sensitive mode, transmitted a 4 millisecond pulse, something like 15 times a second. There was really a race going on between the Lincoln group and the JPL group, who had an 85-foot dish and a CW radar at S-band.
And your frequency was?
440 megacycles.
And this was also an 85-foot, the Millstone dish?
84. Anyway, the JPL people got echoes first, and they had the advantage it was a strictly a Doppler system with no range. So they're only searching in one coordinate. We were searching in range and Doppler.
Mm-hmm.
We did have the advantage over the Georgia Bank people that such a short pulse as a 4-millisecond pulse meant that the frequency window was 250 cycles.
Right.
So we were not as sensitive to a misalignment in Doppler as the Georgia Bank group was with their very long pulse. But we were much more sensitive to the astronomical, the actual value than the mm-hmm. JPL people were only searching in Doppler and had a frequency window. So as soon as they got echoes, they saw them. And we learned from them over the telephone that they were seeing something like, a 20 or 30 cycle offset in Doppler.
From the expected?
From the expected Doppler, which they were using the nominal value, some nominal value of the astronomical unit. And when we finally got echoes, we found we had an ambiguity. We didn't know how many pulses there were in the total flight trip. So we spent the first couple of days essentially repeating the observation but with a different ret rate to see where the pulse moved.
Right.
And from that, deduced very quickly the astronomical unit. And it agreed with their 20-cycle offset. And it supported our interpretation. So we very quickly came up with the value of the astronomical unit. They hadn't taken their Doppler offset and sort of plugged it back in to say what that meant about the astronomical unit at that time. So we cabled both them and the Georgia Bank group with this new value, which proved to be sort of very close to the actual value.
So before that, you heard from JPL, you'd been searching a very wide volume of parameter space.
Well, we'd been running more or less on the nominal, some nominal estimate, which proved to be wrong. And it was only when Venus got close enough that even though we were off in Doppler by some amount, we could begin to see it, did we actually start to get echoes.
So that was in the spring of 61, and then of course every Venus conjunction after that, the work continued on.
Yes. At Lincoln, it gradually transferred over to the big haystack antenna,
right.
which gave us vastly more sensitivity. One of the exciting things was to explain why the echoes at X-band were tending to be weaker than they were at UHF.
Was that discovered in the first season in 61? Or?
It was actually discovered with a smaller instrument than the haystack antenna. No, it was discovered much later. It was done around 64 by a guy called Smith, Bill Smith, who used the 60-foot X-band system and got a cross-section which was 10 dB less than the Venus cross-section at UHF or S-band.
This is at Lincoln Lab now?
Yes. Yeah. And the moon, of course, showed no effect. It has a cross-section which varies slightly but not significantly
right.
with frequency. And so the first guess was... Well, the other observation Smith made was that the echoes were very broadened. And so the thought was it was actually scattering from the atmosphere. Well, it turned out his Doppler broadening was instrumental, and we showed with the haystack radar in about 66, in a couple of experiments, we managed to simultaneously range from Millstone and haystack and showed that the echoes were identical distance, so we really are scattering from the surface, and the Doppler broadening was not very great at all.
I see.
It was comparable to what you'd expect for the frequency difference. So we really were scattering from the surface, and then we were forced to believe that the factor of 10 was due to absorption in the atmosphere. And that was one of the sort of key ingredients in recognizing the enormous atmosphere Venus has.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you could explain a 10 dB change was to put in something like 100 atmospheres of CO2 and N2.
That's right, there really wasn't any value for the atmosphere of Venus. I mean, one would assume it would stick, but you really didn't know whether it was 10 or 100 or 1,000 atmospheres.
Well, there was the problem of explaining the temperature variations of the surface of Venus. And there were people who wanted a greenhouse.
Yeah.
But you could probably get, with 10 atmospheres, you could probably get the greenhouse mm-hmm. up to work. But when the radar measurements showed this 10 dB change, then not really.
Did that require, in fact, 100 atmospheres or
yes,
so?
Yes, it did.
I see.
100 atmospheres is a natural number that gave you.
Which then was, of course, confirmed with the
yes,
in situ
yeah.
measurements.
Yes.
What about the retrograde rotation of Venus? Where did that fit in? I don't remember.
Both the very first observations at Millstone and JPL measured the spectrum. and one observed the total spectral width as Venus went by. And you could try and fit this to solutions for the rotation rate. And both of them independently essentially gave the fact that it was retrograde. I think it was the JPL people who recognized that the actual retrograde motion was very close to the synchronous value you could get if Venus were locked so it faced the Earth every time it went by. I don't think we at Millstone recognized that. But
this was quite startling to see it be retrograde, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
You must have been worried about a missed sign somewhere.
Well, yes, except, you know, we were willing to accept the results. We sort of, you couldn't fit, a normal pattern to it. It had the wrong, you know, the sort of expected the Doppler variation to do this with time and the other way.
Did you find any resistance from the traditional solar system astronomers?
They tended to ignore us. The astronomy books still came out with Venus having a four-day rotation or something for a long time afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we now know that the clouds go around the planet in about 4 days, and this is what was misleading the optical astronomers.
Right. Well, what about the slow rotation period? I mean, that also was completely unexpected. Once again, not much made of it in terms of the...
Well, it excited people like Tommy Gold, it excited the free thinkers who began to worry about just what could do that. And when a little while later Mercury was found to be rotating at 1.5 times synchronous, people recognized that there's no reason for a planet to lock in at exactly synchronous. There are higher harmonics you could lock into. So people search for a harmonic that would lock Venus retrograde. That is, if it had started out retrograde and slowed down, it could spin down perhaps to some state where it got captured.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a mystery. As far as I know, nobody's come up with a good explanation of Venus rotation. It's one of the all-time cosmic mysteries.
Okay, let me just ask one final question. That is, in meteor radar astronomy, which you were not in the late 50s and early 60s, but nevertheless, it seems to me that the field pretty much sort of died. I mean, there are still some studies going on, particularly perhaps from communications and ionospheric point of views, but the astronomy end of it sort of died. And in your view, what was the reason for this demise?
Well, the major problems were solved. People at Chartwell and elsewhere had established that meteors were in fact of solar origin. They were not, interstellar. And they'd established the orbits of most of the intense streams. We've done a lot of work on establishing the orbits of the random meteors. Some of the physics had not been worked out. They didn't really fully understand the rapid diffusion of the meteor trails in those days. But the astronomical aspects had largely been worked out, and a meteor radar was continued into the 60s, partly to study the physics of the problem, and partly for, as it is now, for studies of winds in the upper atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that today remains the primary motive for people doing meteor and echo experiments. The experiments I did were using the 440 megacycle radar at Millstone, and I did that before I got into this Venus thing I was just describing.
When I first got there,
was the first thing I worked on, essentially showed that at this very short wavelength, the trails appear to be very short in length, which implies that they rapidly expand to a fairly large diameter.
At 440 megahertz, you
said? Yes. And the one interesting thing we did do, which I don't think has been done before or since, was to actually point the radar up the direction a meteor would come if it were in a meteor shower, and actually measure a number of meteors that are decelerated down through the atmosphere. Instantaneously get the Doppler shift and see that changing.
I see.
And that's all written up in JGR about 1963 or 64, it's a couple of papers.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Good, because
that ends the interview with John Evans on 7 August 78. This is now talking with Norm Brown.